Good. Well, good morning, everybody, and it's great to be here, and it's great to see old friends and colleagues here, so thank you. Before I start, I just want to remark and remind all of us that this weekend open enrollment started, or open re-enrollment started, for people in the Affordable Care Act. Last year, during open enrollment season, I set a personal goal of helping 100 people enroll. And every time I would get in a taxi, I would ask the cab driver about how they had a chance to sign up for insurance. And I would take out my iPhone and I would figure out what zip code they were in and where they could get in-person help. And I came to New Orleans a year ago and I asked the cab driver, you know, have you had a chance to sign up for health insurance? And he said to me, what's health insurance? Last night I got to the airport late. I got in the cab, I sat down, the cab driver said, are you here for the public health meeting? I said, yes. He said, I'm going to re-enroll in Obamacare this week. It was great. And I have a bunch of questions I wanted to ask you about it. So we spent the drive-in talking about some of the more subtle parts of open enrollment. But all by way of saying, we all have a part to play in this. As we have multiple parts to play in the health of our nation. So I'll challenge all of you to set your own personal enrollment goals and do your part. That was my only disclosure. I have no other personal financial relationships with commercial interests here relevant to this presentation. Let me just start for those of you who are not so familiar with my office. My office, the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, actually was built as a lesson learned after Hurricane Katrina, so it's apt that I'm talking about this here. When Congress decided that all the different parts of public health and healthcare that had to do with emergencies needed to come together in one place. So that was the end of 2006. It's relatively new in government life years, but we've done, I think, a lot in a short time. And our office is now a place where policy coordination meets science, meets response. And that's been the case for every one of the situations that I've needed to deal with. I came into this position in 2009, just as H1N1 was ramping up. And this timeline slide just has a smattering of some of the issues that we've had to deal with since. So you can see, anchored on both ends of my tenure in this job have been infectious diseases, H1N1 and now Ebola, a series of naturally occurring disasters, whether it's earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, man-made bad stuff, whether it is environmental disasters like Deepwater, the West Virginia chemical spill, or tragically the Sandy Hook shootings and Boston bombings. But in each one of these situations, I will say that we look at what happened and we say, what do we need to learn to do better the next time? And the rest of this talk is going to be really focused on one thing I've come to appreciate. We have to do much, much better the next time. That's do science, and do science in a way that informs and addresses community issues and concerns at the same time. It advances our knowledge so we won't be in the same place the next time. So my interest in this, I will say, started before the Haiti earthquake. It started in H1N1. When my second week on the job, I was on a phone call with maybe a dozen intensive care unit doctors from around the country, and each of them were talking about their experience taking care of critically ill patients. Sounds really familiar, doesn't it? And I said, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could get all these data every week? And after a couple of weeks, we could probably develop some practice guidelines and help clinicians understand what it might take to help people survive H1N1. So we worked with NIH and we plugged to an existing research network. And all the folks in this research network were excited. They changed their protocols. They agreed to submit de-identified data every week. And it took their local IRB 6 months to turn around changes to a de-identified protocol. And we completely missed the window for doing anything about it. 18 months later, we learned that 40% of kids who died from H1N1 really died from MRSA. and I just sort of vowed, never again, never can we be in this situation again. This happened because, in fact, we didn't really have the kind of infrastructure we needed to do the full range of science that needed to be done. We did a great job characterizing the virus. We did a great job figuring out what dose of vaccine we needed to give people and whether it was safe. We didn't do such a great job on some of the other things. And so we've been working through why not. So this situation repeated itself in a variety of different ways, and certainly with a variety of things that I think we're here to talk about today. Certainly during the Haiti earthquake, it was a very difficult situation on the ground. The environment was very austere. We had almost no real-time data collection and analysis about a lot of things, but I believe that had we been able to do that, we would have pretty rapidly, again, been able to create better clinical guidelines, for example, about amputation procedures that would have helped many, many people recover, get prostheses, avoid wound infections, do many other things. The Gulf oil spill, which I think is going to be the focus of much of our discussion today, was characterized by a number of things that were very difficult. It happened in a community that had been repeatedly traumatized, and it created pretty quickly a huge amount of uncertainty about what the effects were. We actually convened a meeting down here to try to understand, well, what does the science tell us about oil spills? And I was absolutely horrified to learn that in sort of our history of modern society, we'd had like 40 oil spills of significance around the world. And none of us could stand up and tell anybody in the community or anybody in the audience whether oil and dispersants were bad for people. Because nobody had ever collected the data. No one had ever done the science. I was really inspired by a group in Spain during the Prestige oil spill in maybe 1998. They actually went out and collected biological samples and genetic material from responders. And at that time, they weren't totally sure what to do with it. So they stuck it in a freezer and they kept it there for more than a decade until the science caught up with being able to do something with it. And then we started learning things about it. But what we had, it was a tremendous amount of health worry and concern, turned into a pretty significant epidemic of fear. And people in communities all up and down the coast thought they were smelling things, thought the air was exposing them to different kinds of toxins, thought they were breathing fumes. They got sick. We couldn't tell why, because we didn't know very much about exposure to oil and dispersants or whether it made them sick. But they certainly got sick because of this epidemic of fear. There were these fly-by-night labs, and some of you who are involved in this remember this, who stood up and offered to test people's blood for polyaromatic hydrocarbons. And people who were terrified would fork over $200 for a blood test to be told that they had elevated levels of something that might be in their blood because they smoked a cigarette or they just pumped gas at the pump or something else, probably having nothing to do with exposure that they had. And what we saw was this behavioral health train wreck coming our way. People getting very anxious, getting depressed. We saw spikes in domestic violence and child abuse and other things. And we didn't really need to know. We didn't have the science to know how to prevent that epidemic of fear, how to prevent those behavioral health sequelae. The meeting we had on what happens to people exposed to oil spills had told us one really important thing, that up to 40% of affected communities have long-term behavioral health sequelae after an oil spill. And we didn't know anything about how to prevent that. A huge gap in our science. So again, we vowed, never again. We saw a little bit of a replay of that during the Japan nuclear disaster. And mind you, that was a continent and an ocean away. And yet in the United States, you could not buy potassium iodide anywhere because people were terrified and it flew off the shelves. Again, we had an epidemic of fear, which we weren't entirely sure how to deal with. We also found that we had some other limitations. We were limited internationally in our number of scientists and experts who really knew enough about the situation, health physicists, for example, to help us help the public understand and address their health worries and concerns. And then we had some other pretty significant gaps. If you had to use potassium iodide in a situation, how do you dose it in a kid? Turns out that there's three different guidelines, and none of them are completely harmonized. How would you figure that out in the midst of a crisis? Great question in my mind. So one of the things I think that's been clear through all of this has been that during these different kinds of emergencies, depending on where you are and who's involved and how good or not the risk communication is, people take in information differently, they process information differently, and they act differently in the face of adversity. You know, look at the difference between Katrina and Isaac down here. Look at the difference between the oil spill here and Fukushima. Look at lots of differences. But our jobs are, first of all, to remain really cognizant of the issues and the diversity of issues. And policymakers and communities often have really, really different concerns. And we need to understand them both. We need to engage the community and engage affected communities particularly, and understand that pretty quickly, perception can become reality. So in communities here, the perception that they were not safe led to a reality that people got sick. You know, our teams that were here on the ground to help with various things ended up going out almost every night to community meetings and just sitting, you know, in community centers, in churches, in whatever, listening to people, listening to concerns. I remember one of my team members got beat up because fishermen wanted to take him out in a boat and show him that if you took a piece of gauze and you put it on the string and you dropped it into the water, it would come up brown because it was covered with oil. So he went out on the boat and did this and listened to the community and listened to the community's concerns. And the gauze did come up brown, but it was covered with algae. It's really interesting. And then to try to communicate those kinds of findings back to a community in ways that they could hear and ways that they could trust. Terribly, terribly important. We now have another epidemic of fear. And again, we are challenged to think about how to get on top of it. We have a really terrible, terrible situation in West Africa. We've had now 10 patients in the United States, two of whom contracted the disease in the United States. Sadly, the patient who was evacuated over the weekend passed away this morning in Nebraska. But this, I think, will only continue to fuel public fears and concerns. But these epidemics of fear are insidious, and they spread rapidly. In almost any emergency, one of our jobs is to get on top of them. So some of the basic principles for dealing with fear and dealing with risk communication, I know other speakers are going to talk about, and so I'm not really going to go through the first set of bullets on the slide. But what I do want to do is focus on the last bullet on the slide, which is listen to public concerns, listen to community concerns. We do that with on the ground, sitting in a room listening. We do it some now with social media monitoring, which is really interesting. And you need to put a number of those things together to get a sense of what people's issues or concerns are, but then to make a commitment to be able to answer the unanswered questions and to share information as it becomes available. Sometimes that information isn't going to be available really quickly. Are there long-term sequelae from exposure to oil and dispersants? Maureen and her team, other folks, are answering that question. But it's going to take not days, not weeks, sometimes years, and to continue to engage communities and talk to them, hear their concerns, answer their questions, and at the end of the day, not go back into our, you know, academic spaces and forget that we have an opportunity to tell people what it is that we're doing. Obviously, communicating risk as well as communicating science gets better when we have good information. And as information became available from testing seafood on the Gulf, you know, we were able to tell people it's safe to eat your Gulf Coast seafood, and in fact, it's delicious. We've been doing some other work in New Orleans to empower decision making through information. And I'll just say this is a map. As you can see, recognize the Crescent City here and the city of New Orleans. But it's a map of people who live at home with electrical medical devices and who, if the power went out with another hurricane, would not be able to stay at home alone. This is information that we've put together in a collaboration with Medicare, and we were able to use Medicare data to figure out who's electricity dependent, who's on dialysis, who has a set of special needs that we need to get on top of in a disaster. And we can use that in a very de-identified way for planning. But we've done a couple drills down with the city of New Orleans. And our first one, we actually went out and knocked on people's doors to be sure that the Medicare data was right and gave us accurate information. Turns out 93% of the time it was right. People were thrilled to have us come and knock on their door and say, we're just trying to get ready for hurricane season, and do you have an oxygen concentrator? Yes, I do. Can you tell me, does it have backup batteries, and how long do they last? Batteries? I don't know. I know it plugs into the wall. So, a lot of work to do there. Last year, when New Orleans had its probably, I hope, once-in-a-lifetime snowstorm, in advance of the storm, the city health department called all 50-some-odd people who were on dialysis and said, we're going to have a storm. Why don't you come in and get dialyzed early? And they did, and they had no adverse events when the power was out and people couldn't travel and get to dialysis in a storm. So information provides information. It reduces fear. It empowers decision-making. It reduces risk. And carefully done science, which I'll be talking about at noon, helps to be sure that we are never in the same place twice. So one of my goals is in any emergency for us to be able to identify a science agenda early on, like within the first days to weeks, to pull people together to understand what a prioritized research agenda looks like and then to act on it. We did that first, albeit way too late, with Deepwater. After Hurricane Sandy, maybe 3 weeks into it, we pulled together a group again in an affected community, New York and New Jersey. We listened to the community tell us about what their needs were. And they told us that we don't know a lot about what helps communities recover faster and better. And they don't really know a lot about what makes people resilient. And we were able to fund a host of studies which are now ongoing, while recovery is still ongoing from Hurricane Sandy, to understand how to do a better job building resilience. And about 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting hosted by the Institute of Medicine on the priority research agenda, particularly regarding environmental issues for Ebola. And kudos to the IOM, they pulled it together quickly, and they got a report to us out just at the end of last week that lists the priority research agenda items that need to be acted on, so that we again can, in real time, understand people's worries and concerns, and hopefully, in short order, identify the science or do the science that addresses those concerns so that we can all be more informed. Even if we don't like the answers, it's always better to have them and deal with facts than deal with rumor and innuendo. And that is a huge part of what disaster management is about. So thank you very much. I look forward to the rest of the session. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to be on a call with our Ebola coordinator at the White House. So if people have a couple questions now, I'm happy to take them. Yeah.
For Dr. Lurie, a few questions so that she can take her call and we can treasure every minute we have with her. Please, please state your name and where you're from.
My name is Bridget Byrd from Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. Do you think that research agenda could actually be formulated in advance? You're talking kind of...
Yeah.
But I think there's probably a lot of stuff we could do before...
There is a lot we can do in advance, and if you are able to come to the session later in the day, my colleague Aubrey Miller from NIHS will be joining us. And in fact, NIHS has taken the lead in sort of putting together a set of templated protocols and data collection tools. So generically, we know that certain kinds of environmental disasters are going to lead to X, Y, and Z question, and that we need to be poised, ready to go, even maybe with IRB approval, or partial IRB review with preset protocols with study designs. We've done the same thing with some of our medical countermeasures. So since you're, from Children's Hospital, so for example, we got anthrax vaccine in the stockpile in case there's ever an anthrax release. Well, anthrax vaccine has never been in a kid. You can't do that pre-disaster because of a set of human subjects and ethics issues. So how would we be ready to go, moment one, day one, if the public was terrified and we had to do this? So we do put together a number of those things in a place, and we continue to fine-tune them. That said, we always learn that new situations present things that we've never really thought about before. I'm looking and thinking about our Ebola situation here right now. And that the public always has worries and concerns and fears that you can't anticipate. So not only have we put together a team to identify the priority research agenda, a precursor to that has to be to put together a team rapidly to scour the face of the earth for the best available science. Our colleagues at the National Library of Medicine and others help us with that. So in fact, pretty quickly, we understand what science we can communicate to the public. We did that, I think, very well with the West Virginia chemical spill, for example. And it took learning that there was lots of proprietary research that really was not in the general literature about the compound that was spilled that helped us be able to understand more about the science and then respond to it appropriately.
Good to see you.
You know, it's a great question, and I guess I think the most important lesson learned is that people are people no matter where you go. They need to be treated like people. You don't assume that they know a lot. You need to communicate in plain English. You can't over-communicate enough, to quote a famous person. And you need to understand and address their worries and concerns just like you need to address those of the public.
We'll take one more question. Yes.
Yeah, hi, it's Tito from LSU in New Orleans. I have a concern because you talked about the long-term effects of some of these disasters, and yet the NIH is not going to continue funding the long-term studies, per se. And so I'm afraid we're going to stay in this domain of still not being able to answer the questions that come up about these long-term problems. And I realize you don't control how dollars get allocated, but it seems like here, and I'm sure it's true with other things, once people start collecting data, if it stops too early, we'll never get any closer.
I hear you, and I appreciate the concern, and no, that's not a budget that I control, as I told folks in Congress last week. But, you know, I would offer another comment, which is part of the reason it is so important to understand the science agenda and be poised to do the science really early is because data collection for that study got started a full 10 to 12 months after the spill. Had we been week one, day one, out there collecting data, collecting samples, collecting information from people who were potentially exposed, we would have had a much higher probability of being able to answer our basic research questions. So, in fact, if resources are scarce, you want to put them where, in fact, you think you have the greatest hope of being able to have actionable, scientifically sound data. And part of the reason I'm so focused on science preparedness and response is to be sure that we get out of the gates quickly and that we have actionable data that will answer our questions so we won't be in the same situation twice. So I'm fearful that the next oil spill will say, well, we've had 41 oil spills. We tried really hard the last time to figure out if oil and dispersants are bad for you, but really missed the window to figure that out. And I would like, number one, not to have another oil spill like that, but number two, if we have an environmental disaster that is unfolding in front of us, to be able to get out of the blocks at the get-go, to your point about shouldn't we have these protocols written and ready to go, the answer is yes.
Thank you so Thanks. Much. Please join me in thanking Dr. And so Dr. Lurie's presentation set us up nicely for the next issue, and the next presenter, Professor Ragnar Lofstedt, joins us from the UK. He is professor in risk management, and he's the director of the King's Center on Risk Management in London. He actually is very knowledgeable and works very often in our country, in the UK, in the US. Has both his BA and MA from UCLA, his PhD from Clark University. Has conducted research in risk communication and management with specific expertise on issues of chemical, environment, food, and pharmaceutical areas. He is knowledgeable and an expert in policy, and particularly the transparency of policies. He's been honored and is the editor, currently editor-in-chief of the Journal for Risk Research, and has been honored by our Society for Risk Analysis, both as a fellow of the Society of Risk Analysis, and in 2006 he received the Outstanding Service Award from the Society. And Dr. Lostek will talk about the very issue that Dr. Lurie left us with, and what happens when social amplification of risk occurs. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lostek.
Thank you.
Yeah.